Winchell is 19. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited to begin today's program with Katie Koble. Katie Koble is the director of theatrical activities. She perhaps has a fancier title than that at Horlick High School in the Racine Unified School District. But the point of our conversation today is that she is also directing the current production at the Racine Theater Guild, a delightful show called Nonsense, a show which was supposed to open actually last weekend, and the opening had to be postponed. And we'll be talking about that in just a moment. But it looks like the production can begin with performances tonight and perhaps next weekend as well. Fingers crossed. And so I'm excited to be able to speak with Katie Koble for the next few minutes about this production and what it feels like for her to be back at the Racine Theater Guild, not as a performer on the stage, but as the director of this production of Nonsense. Katie Koble, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. Happy to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. Real quick, tell our listeners a little bit about where you come from originally and briefly your professional path that ultimately takes you to this current position that you have at Horlick.
Absolutely. So I am born and raised in Racine, Wisconsin, actually, product of Racine Unified School District. And after I graduated from Park in 2005, I went to University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the Peck School of the Arts there, where I studied theater, education, and had a minor in technical theater. And while I was there, I worked for several different companies in Milwaukee. I worked for the now-defunct Milwaukee Shakespeare Company. I worked for In Tandem Theater, Milwaukee Chamber Theater, and Milwaukee Repertory Theater. And from there, upon graduation, I was offered the position at Horlick, where I've been there since 2010, and have been the director of theater there. And in 2017, I was actually brought back, and I'm now also a faculty member at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Peck School of the Arts, back in my old stomping grounds in the theater department, now as a adjunct teaching the future theater educators of Wisconsin.
Wonderful. And speaking of old stomping grounds, you also have some history with the Racine Theater Guild, although I don't remember you directing a production before Nonsense, but correct me if I'm wrong. But tell our listeners a little bit about your involvement with the Theater Guild before Nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. I tell the joke to people that my time at Theater Guild started before I was even a glimmer in my parents' eye, because my parents actually met here in the 1980s, and they were very heavily involved in the theater for a very long time. And I my first production here was in 2003. I was in Honk, and I've been in multiple productions here. In 2014, 15 season, I directed Almost Maine here on the main stage, and I've directed six Racine Children's Theater productions, the most recent one being Junie B. Jones, the musical.
Very good. And thank you for reminding me about Almost Maine. That's something I so enjoyed that production and what you did with it, but it had slipped my mind that you were the director of it. So I think that's terrific.
Okay. It was a while ago,
right?
But I'm happy to be back.
Right. And I should think it's really interesting to be on your own old stomping grounds, and of course this is true in a couple of different spheres of your life, but in a different role than once upon a time. It's a little different than acting in a production and then things happen and you're gone for 15 years and then you come back and act in something else. That's also kind of a nice return to your stomping grounds, but you're returning with a very different sort of role, a very different sort of responsibility.
Yeah, it's what I've really loved about being a member of Racine Theatre Guild as long as I have is I've had the opportunity to volunteer my time in, I think I've done actually every single production role you can. The only one I believe I have not done is I have not done sound design for a show, but everything else I've done. And it's really lovely to come back and to direct a show and to work alongside, you know, some of my friends and people that some of them have watched me grow up, you know, because I've been participating here since I was in high school. And it's just, it's really lovely to come back and to create something together and to be the person kind of leading the ship, you know, captaining the ship, doing that. And so it's just really nice to come back, and the support has just been outstanding, as it always is here.
Was it always your intention to be a director, or to kind of split your efforts between directing and performing, or is directing was that an opportunity that kind of presented itself to you and kind of shifted your course in terms of what you were most interested in pursuing theatrically?
Yeah, so when I went into college, I very much was focused on the performing aspect. And I had done some technical theater here and there, but I hadn't really done a ton. My dad was a technical director as well, and had some technical background with that. But I hadn't really done anything like that. And when I got GWM, my sophomore year, I took a directing class. And from there, that class, taught by my brilliant directing professor, Jenny Wanasek, was what kind of lit the spark. And it created within me this opportunity where I was like, this I really enjoy doing, because I love, as a director, to look at something that has been done before and to create something new out of it. And that's been... That's always been a lovely challenge and just a really exciting adventure that I go on with every production that I direct. So that was really what it was, is I was like, nope, I love directing, and it's the thing that I love to do the most now.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Katie Coble in this portion of the morning show. She teaches theater for the Racine Unified School District at Horlick, and she is also directing the current production at the Racine Theater Guild, a production of the musical Nonsense. Katie, for anybody who has never encountered this show, Nonsense, explain to them a little bit about its background. I mean, how old a show is this? Is this something that was on Broadway, or does it originate in kind of a quieter corner of the musical theater world?
Yeah, so Nonsense was created by the playwright, and it was sort of a love letter to the nuns that had been an integral part of his life and an integral part of his educational career. And even if you look within the script, he indicates the five nuns that you see within the show. He references the nuns that inspired each of those characters, which is really, I think, quite lovely. And it started and performed off-Broadway for a very long time. It's had a lot of touring productions. And for a while, it was one of the longest running productions off-Broadway. And it's actually one that you can view online. There's a recording of a production starring actually Rue McClanahan from The Golden Girls as Mother Superior, which is quite fun and silly to see her in a different light.
So for someone who's not seen this, explain a little bit about the sort of wacky plot that we follow through the course of this show.
Sure. So Nonsense tells the story of five sisters of the Little Sisters of Hoboken in New Jersey, who have found themselves needing to raise funds to bury four of their fellow sisters. And the sisters did not die of natural causes. They actually, in fact, passed away because they were poisoned, along with a number of other nuns within their order, by their cook, Sister Julia, Child of God. And they die of botulism from a poisoned soup. And so the five nuns that you see on stage have put together a benefit show filled with, you know, songs and dance and comedy and all that sort of thing to raise funds so that they can bury the last four dead sisters. Otherwise, they're going to be in the freezer until the health inspector comes a knocking on the door.
There are a couple of things about this show that set it apart from your standard play or your standard musical, and I think one of the most important is kind of the relationship between these five nuns and their relationship with the audience. Explain a little bit about what goes on in that respect in Nun Sense.
Yeah, so what the audience will see when they come to see the show is that the fourth wall does not exist in this show. The fourth wall we talk about in theater, where it's between the audience and the stage and they're viewing it. The audience is brought into the production and is talked to by a couple of the sisters almost immediately when the show begins. And so what you see within that is it allows there to be this almost relaxed nature to the evening where you are ready to go along on this kind of evening of song and dance and fun together. And you expect, as an audience member, that you're going to see just a performance. But what ends up happening is, of course, there's hijinks and chaos that ensues and things like that. But what it comes down to, and what I love about the story, is yes, there's that comedy, there's the dancing, there's the singing. But at the end of the day, it's also this story of these five women who have dedicated their life to their order, to their vocation, and they have that common thread. And the love that they show each other in different moments throughout the show is one of my favorite things about the story and about the production.
Towards that end, casting a show like this is an especially important matter. That is, if you have kind of a big cast, you can have a couple of people that aren't quite up to the task, but they kind of get absorbed in the grand whole of it. But when you have five performers of relatively comparable significance, it really is important to cast a quintet that really hangs together and works well together.
Yeah, absolutely. What's really outstanding about the cast is each one of them is kind of a powerhouse in their own way. Each of them has a very specific thing that they are very strong at. One of them, it's comedy, and one of them, it is their dancing ability, and one of it is their singing. But that said, they all are those triple threats. They all can sing and dance and act, and they all are just outstanding in the roles that they do, because each character, each one of the sisters has their own solo number, at least one, some of them two or three. There's tap dancing in the show, which is, in my opinion, one of the hardest forms of dance that there is, and it's this big, massive, you know, number within the show. And they really hold their own, and it really proves to be an enjoyable experience for everybody.
I touched on the matter of opening night of this particular production of Nun Sense, which was supposed to be last weekend. Explain to our listeners what necessitated the postponement of opening night of Nun Sense at the Racine Theater Guild.
Absolutely. So we have been following incredibly strict guidelines. We've been following the CDC and City of Racine Health Department recommendations and the Racine Theater Guild policy. Everybody's been fully masked. We've been, you know, doing everything we possibly can. But unfortunately, we had some breakthrough cases of COVID within the cast and crew that forced us to make the incredibly difficult decision that for the safety of not only our performers, our crew, as well as the audience, we needed to postpone the opening by a week. And they're ready to go. I can hear some of them. I'm at the theater right now, and I can hear some of them coming in right now. So,
I know that there was a brief time when it was possible that you would be stepping in if certain things didn't go right in terms of test results and so on. That must be kind of an odd sensation to be not only the director, but also presumably one of the primary alternates or understudies should somebody be felled by a positive COVID test.
Yeah, so we actually had one person understudies the youngest nun, and then I understudied the other four nuns. And we were in a situation where I all of a sudden had to understudy the youngest nun. And I had a brief stint for one rehearsal for one act, and then it was proven to not be necessary. And so I am back to just the directing side of things, which, while it would have been fun to giggle with those ladies on stage, I definitely, for this production, prefer to be sitting on the directing side of it.
And it really is a sign of the effectiveness of really strict protocols when they are followed strictly, that it can work, because the case or cases we're talking about remained isolated, and it did not fire through the rest of the cast or all through the crew, I mean, as it so easily could if people were not being extraordinarily careful. Just give our listeners a sense of what kind of protocols we are talking about in terms of keeping the cast and crew as safe as possible while undertaking this production.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyone working on the production has to show proof of vaccination to our production stage manager and myself as the director, whoever the director is for the shows. Unvaccinated people, when they come into the theater regardless, have to wear a mask no matter what. But our audience has to wear a mask, unvaccinated or not, for the entire time that they are in RTG's space. Our actors on stage are only unmasked when they come onto stage. The minute they leave stage, they have masks put back on. Our crew is entirely masked, even though they're vaccinated the entire time. And we are all wearing the highest grade masks we possibly can. Everybody's wearing N95s when they're here, and we're maintaining social distancing and sanitation and all of that sort of thing. So we're being very, very specific and very clear with what our expectations are on that, because we just want it to be safe, and we want everybody to be healthy, and we want everybody to be able to enjoy theater and not have that lingering fear, you know, that they're not going to be safe.
How difficult has it been to direct this production where for every single rehearsal, for the entire duration of the rehearsal, you are dealing with actors who are masked? What kind of difference has that made for you as a director and for these performers as well? I think that's sometimes a complication that people don't maybe stop to really fully consider.
Absolutely. So, yeah, as you said, our entire rehearsal process, everybody was masked. The only space in the theater where people can go unmasked is on the stage, and that is when we are in the theater space. But if we are in the rehearsal space, if we're anywhere else, we have to be masked. And so, you know, it's been interesting because the actors, one of them teased the other day that their lung capacity has actually increased because they've had to sing and dance, you know, through masks for 6 weeks. But what it does is it forces the actors to use the rest of their body more to get the comedy across. And when they have taken their mask off, when we've gotten into dress rehearsals and they've been able to see the lower half of each other's faces, and they all know what each other look like, but when they've been able to do that, it has really, you know, sort of set the spark. But it's given them this nice challenge of exercising their acting chops in a different way and, you know, kind of pushing themselves a little bit farther than they normally would have to, because they're having to use every other part of their body because their nose and mouth can't be seen to get the story across and to get the comedy and the humor across.
Hmm. You certainly have five talented performers, Juliana and Ellie and Robin and Cara and Betty. And I want to just give you a chance to say a word about Cara's presence in this production, because this is kind of a special return of sorts for Kara?
Yeah, so Kara performed in Racine Theatre Guild's first production of Nonsense, where she played Sister Mary Leo, who is the youngest nun. She's the novice. And so this has been a return to, and she was also in Nonsense too, the sequel that Theatre Guild did the following year. And so this has been a nice return to the material for her. And I think it's been a fun challenge for her just to play a completely different role. And it's a very different, as an actor and as a character, it's a very different headspace between Sister Mary Leo and Sister Robert Ann. And she's definitely risen to the challenge and is just doing an outstanding bang-up job. So.
Right. So just wanted to make sure people understood that. And this is Kara Ernst Schock, who has done some choreographing and directing at the Guild as well, but on stage for Nonsense with some very talented castmates, for sure. A last question. As the name suggests and as the story suggests, this is a story that is essentially about Catholic nuns, five of them. Mm-hmm. What would you say to somebody in terms of the way this show treats the whole matter of, for instance, the Catholic faith? Because there are different ways to put a fun show together, including ways that might be a spoof that for some people probably might go too far or cross a certain line towards kind of disrespect or making fun or making light or whatever. And what's your take on the way this show approaches that matter? And I really want to ask that because there'll be people coming to this who might be devout Catholics, for instance, and it's probably important for them to know what they're going to experience.
Absolutely. So how I like to put it is that it is a fun but respectful way of sort of poking fun at nuns and at just the fact that I think what it does is it shows you that nuns are also still people and they still have a sense of humor and they still, because I think with any, you know, Catholicism aside, I think with any religion, sometimes there can be this stigma that, well, if they're a leader of a religious organization or belief system, that it's sort of, oh, well, no, they're a priest, or nope, they're a pastor. And I think that this allows it to just sort of let their, you know, let their hair down, even though you can't see their hair, but just to have a fun sort of playful way at it. And we have a couple of people in the cast who are Catholic, and we have some crew members who are Catholic, and they've been giggling this whole time. And so I don't think that there's anything in there that is going to be too salacious or anything like that. It's all in good fun. It's all in good humor. It's all in good faith. So
very good. So there are some seats available, I assume, for performances this weekend and next weekend. We hope that those performances, of course, can happen. What do people do if they want to attend Nonsense at the Theatre Guild?
So what they need to do is they can just call our box office and place a ticket order there. Tickets are also available online for purchase. And we did end up adding a show next Sunday night on Closing Sunday. So we're not closing on a 2 o'clock show. We're closing on a 7 o'clock show. So there's 5 opportunities to see it this weekend and multiple opportunities to see it next weekend.
Very good. And at the helm, Katie Coble, director of the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Nonsense. Katie, thank you for making time for this interview in what I know is a very, very busy day. And best wishes to you and to the cast and crew of Nonsense.
Thank you so much, Greg. Thanks for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I have a feeling that many of you have in your closets at home what I have in my closet as well. Beautiful, wonderful, comfortable, inspiring t-shirts and sweatshirts with the label, Life is Good. And on top of that, maybe you have baseball caps or dog leashes or even a really neat little book called Life is Good, Simple Words from Jake and Rocket. This is an extraordinarily successful company created and run by two brothers, Bert and John Jacobs. And the whole idea behind the marvelous products which they create is to spread the power of optimism. And they do that in all kinds of different ways. And one of the best things about the company Life is Good is that they do so many things to make the world a better place, not only donating 10% of their profits right off the top to some very, very worthy charities, but also in the way that they conduct their business and interact with their customers, they are doing so much good. They have a book called Life is Good, The Book, How to Live with Purpose and Enjoy the Ride, in which they lay out not only the lives of optimism which they have lived and where that optimistic spirit came from, but also lay out for us, the readers, 10 different superpowers which aid them in living the lives that they do. And it's an absolutely terrific book. I already plan to get several of them and share them as gifts. It's not often I say that so blatantly over the air, but I have no hesitancy in saying it about this book called Life is Good. And I'm thrilled to be able to speak with Bert and John Jacobs, the founders of Life is Good and the co-authors of this absolutely terrific book. Bert and John Jacobs, we welcome you to the morning show.
We really appreciate you having us on.
Happy to be talking to you. Really happy to be talking to you. I wish we had more time to be able to talk about something that's really delicious in your book, which is your account of your childhood, which you call Our Perfectly Imperfect Childhood, in which you say your folks have bitten off a lot by trying to raise a family of six kids on a slim salary. A familiar story, I'm sure, to a lot of people. One of the things you say, though, is your mom was the first powerful optimist in your lives. Tell our listeners some of the ways in which that powerful optimism was lived out and made such a deep impression on you.
Yeah, there were really, you know, every family faces challenges, and there were really two major factors that in our childhood that were challenging. One was economics and maybe too many kids and not enough money. And the other was that our parents had a near-death car accident when we were in grade school. And our mom had a seatbelt on and so survived with only broken bones. Dad almost died and ended up losing the use of his right arm. And he became heavily depressed, and yelling and screaming in the household became a daily soundtrack. That was extremely challenging, but our mom was the one that really kept the family together. And she did so by focusing on what was right rather than what was wrong. So she had a tradition at the dinner table where she looked around and said to all of us, "Tell me something good that happened today." And as simple as that request was, it changed the energy in the house. So, you know, years later as adults, when we kind of landed on our feet and started selling T-shirts, it became a huge factor in, you know, sort of funneling us towards a more optimistic message, which ended up being Life is Good. So our mom really was the first powerful optimist in our lives, taught us a lot, and was the inspiration for Life is Good.
Hmm. And we'll talk a little more about her story before we're done. Explain to our listeners how and why you first got the idea of trying to make your living selling T-shirts. It sounds like there were a couple of different things at play in your mind. And we're talking about your first efforts before you ultimately founded this incredibly successful company. But in the early going with that really modest beginning, what was at the heart of choosing that as what you hoped would be a path to success?
Well, I think we felt T-shirts were a great canvas for messages. We've always liked to write and draw since we were kids. Our mom was an artist, and I encouraged that sort of thing. And we also looked at it as an accessible way to combine art and business. And we were looking, as we got to college and talked more and more about what we wanted to do, we didn't really know, but we thought it would be incredible to be able to create art for a living somehow, and that's what led us to T-shirts. And then we just gave it a shot. We went to a screen printer, and we took to the streets of Boston, and then bought this used van and started going up and down the East Coast selling in college dorms.
One of the things I appreciated about your book is you really lay out the tough road that was. I heard some relatively vague accounts about how you started really small and it was not easy in the early going, but wow, you guys really hit some walls and a lot of people who were not at all receptive to what you were doing. And it seems like this was one of those paths of great discouragement, and somehow your optimistic spirit survived that.
Yeah, I think in one way to look at it is it's all we had. You know, we didn't have money, we didn't have experience, and we really didn't have professional skills. But we had a message that, or even before life is good, we did have the optimism. We had that, you know, taught to us since we were kids. So, you know, one thing that prevents people from starting businesses and taking risks or chasing their dreams is that they're afraid to fail. And one thing that an optimist can do, and it was very powerful to us early on, was we didn't look at days as failures where we didn't sell any T-shirts. So we could be in the street selling all day and at night in the dormitories and not sell a single T-shirt. And rather than saying we failed today, we would look at it and say we learned today. What did we learn? We didn't sell those shirts for a reason. Either we had the wrong graphic, or we had the wrong color, or we were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we can improve based on that. We looked at it as a benefit that we learned. And then the next day, you know, of course, you can't have too many of those days in a row. So the next day, you have to make adjustments and get out in the market and do something different. I think, you know, the way you frame things and the way you view the world is very powerful. And that's what optimism is about. A pessimist will focus on the obstacles, but an optimist will focus on the opportunities. And that's kind of what kept us going in the early days.
I love the phrase at one point in the book when you describe these early days as a lot of trial and even more error. But at some point...
we've made a lot of mistakes.
At some point, though, you ended up creating this now iconic figure known as Jake. Just briefly describe kind of the moment when there was that creative spark, and in particular the person who kind of saw that drawing and said something about it that really kind of drew it all together.
Yeah, so this was a big lesson to us that ends up kind of continuing throughout our whole careers with Life is Good. One conversation while we were traveling in the van was about the fact that the media is almost systematic pessimism in that it inundates our culture with negative information, always reinforcing what's going wrong in the world. And we wanted to create some symbol that celebrated what's right with the world. So JJ drew Jake with crayon and magic markers, the original character. And when we got back to Boston, we had a tradition of throwing a keg party. We put all of our artwork up on the walls, and a girl who was at the party drew an arrow to Jake and wrote, it didn't say life is good, it didn't say, you know, she just wrote, this guy's got life figured out. And we loved that, but we realized it was too many words, so in the morning we distilled that into the three words, life is good, and that was it. So the lesson, you know, 2 days later we sold them in the street, we sold 48 T-shirts in 45 minutes, and it was immediately commercially viable. But the lesson was that we didn't have to come up with it. You know, people will help you and people will come up with ideas for you if you enable them. That's, you know, part of why, you know, one of the superpowers is openness. You have to be open to people. So immediately that girl at that party, she kind of gave it to us without knowing it. We were searching for something, but in a sense, she came up with it, you know. And then we were smart enough to distill it and then to trademark it. And, you know, that continues, as I said. So, like, the retailers then evolved our brand for us. And today it still continues. It's our customer base that's building the business with us.
Hmm.
And if I could add, you know, the customers that taught us the most were the ones that wrote these incredibly personal stories about going through adversity and, you know, whether it's chemotherapy, losing loved ones, and they would say that optimism helped them, you know, focus on what they should be grateful for, just for having a sandwich, just for having a friend to talk to, just for hanging out with their dog, and these simple pleasures that we often take for granted. People that go through tremendous adversity, they have this heightened sense of gratitude. And so to Bert's point, you know, we learn from our friends at the keg party, then the retailers, then, you know, this deepest message of all was like that life is not perfect, life is not easy, but life is good. And if, especially if you're able to focus on what's right in your life and the world and grow that good. And that's where these superpowers, you know, we call them superpowers. They're values that are accessible to everybody. And they all come from our customers. So, you know, you get enough letters from people that are going through really difficult things, and they express that they're so appreciative of what they have in their life, that you realize that gratitude is a superpower. You get enough letters from people that say, you know, what they're drawn to about life is good is the simplicity of it. It's childlike. It's so simple. Their life is so complex. There's too much information, et cetera. And they want to just focus on the things that they love. So simplicity to us becomes a superpower. You know, the same is true of creativity, of authenticity, openness, courage, all of these things that are kind of timeless. But the more, all we had to do was kind of listen to our customer base. And over time, these things showed up so many times over and over that we said, okay, that's it. Those are the things that are enabled by this this thing we call optimism. And maybe the most important thing is that optimism really isn't a soft philosophy. It's a pragmatic strategy for approaching life. And, you know, the more we practice it, the more we wake up in the morning and say, okay, you know, how do I focus on what's right in my life rather than what's wrong? That's the things that are going to grow. We're able to put our resources towards making our life happier and more fulfilling.
We're speaking with Bert and John Jacobs, the founders of the company Life is Good, and we're talking specifically about a really terrific book that has just been published by National Geographic, actually, called Life is Good, the book. And yes, indeed, the heart and soul of this book is the array of 10 superpowers, as you call them, that that can be, in a sense, the ingredients to a truly optimistic life. When you talk about openness in the first chapter, you talk about two words that are so important, and those words are yes and. Saying a quick no stops the flow, yes and lets you build and grow. And that's really a way in which you've lived that out in the way that you've grown your company.
Yeah, you know, that phrase originated from improv comedy, and that's the secret to why actors can get on stage and support each other and create a scene out of nothing but a suggestion. And it's amazing to watch live, but you can actually apply it to your everyday personal life, work. I mean, we've all been in meetings where people are afraid to offer new ideas because, you know, the first instinct sometimes is for others to talk about why it won't work. If you flip that and just kind of roll, give it a few minutes to breathe and say, yes, I like that, and what if we do this as well? The momentum is, like, unstoppable. You can always edit it out at the end of the meeting and decide to go in another direction, but to give ideas a little chance to breathe and grow is huge. And think about that in your personal life. Your friend wants to take an adult ed class, or your spouse or something. Instead of telling them why that doesn't make sense or you're too busy, yes and, maybe, you know, I'd love to take that with you, or I've been thinking about taking this class. Any conversation can be aided by that simple phrase.
The second chapter is devoted to courage, and in this chapter you tell an incredible story about your sister, Berta, and a devastating injury which she suffers while in a skiing accident, and her remarkable comeback. It must have been especially touching for you to share this kind of a story, which had such a powerful connection to the two of you so directly?
It was hard. Yes. Yeah, there's, you know, there's you have feelings for a long time. I mean, our sister, it was a paralyzing ski accident. She'll immediately following the accident, she was completely paralyzed, unable to move. But over time, in our opinion, her courage, her optimism, her openness, and a great team of doctors, you know, enabled her recovery. And while her body will never be the same, you know, the important thing to us is that the accident caused her tremendous pain and difficulty in her life. But it never took her beautiful smile away, because she knows that's who she is, you know. And so the courage to embrace and to rehab and to work her way back as best she could is a superpower. But, you know, the authenticity superpower is there, too, because she kept that smile through everything and has been a huge inspiration to us. She asked herself, you know, when she was in the hospital, you know, what are her choices, you know? She could frown and, you know, or she could smile. And she said, if the smile is the courageous choice, that's an easy one for me, because if I get upset, how's that going to affect my family and everybody else? So, you know, she thought about everybody else involved. And so she's been just a huge inspiration to us.
And that mental switch went off in the hospital, she said, where she said, I'm going to focus on the progress, you know, and every little bit. She wiggled a toe one day. She moved her hands, and that was like where she focused all her energy, on what was the next step of progress, and that's something we can all learn from.
I love the quote you have of her at one point saying, every step of the way, I felt lucky. I mean, it's amazing when someone, in the midst of something like that.
To this day, she has tremendous challenges, you know, and setbacks, but she says, another one I love that she said is, I don't let it ruin, you know, it's going to ruin my next 10 minutes, but I'm not going to let it ruin my next hour. And that's how she looks at these things that would frustrate us all very much, because her hands don't work very well and she doesn't move around too well, but she does not dwell on that stuff. She's a real inspiration to us all.
I'm sure. You talk so beautifully about simplicity, the importance of, in your words, chiseling away at the excess and cutting to the core. You quote Thoreau and Leonardo da Vinci saying that simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, which I like so much. I appreciate what you write in one chapter about humor and in another chapter about fun. And about fun, you say that fun is more than just frivolous. It really can make an enormous difference. And it sounds like you take fun very seriously at Life is Good. I mean, even in terms of how you conduct your business, the way your workplace is put together, you really are anxious to foster that.
Yeah, there's a saying. We've found that in general, in business and adults in general, we tend to get away from that superpower of fun. And, you know, it's magnetic. It really draws people in. It's attractive. And we've found that for our staff, they're actually more productive, and we're more productive together when we're able to have some fun. So we talk about blurring the line between work and play, and you know, this idea of hump day on Wednesday and grinding through your work week, and even the phrase work-life balance doesn't make sense to us, because you know, by very definition, that would mean that they counter or oppose each other. And that doesn't make sense. I think the better approach, regardless of what you do for a living, is, you know, find some fun in the week. Find some way to bring fun and bring the things that you love to your office, to your work. Because the chances are, if you're able to do that, you're going to be more passionate about your work. You're going to be more enthusiastic about it. And you're going to attract better, stronger, more talented people, because who doesn't want to have some fun?
And as especially as we become adults, that has to be a conscious decision to inject fun. I'm going to bring fun and a certain energy to my coworkers, to when I get home from work. And we find, as Bert said, it's unifying, and it kind of lifts the whole team and actually makes you more productive in addition to making the workplace a lot more enjoyable.
You also talk about compassion, creativity, authenticity. When you talk about dogs and you end with love, nothing is stronger than love. A beautiful account of the in the wake of the Boston Marathon. Your company is based in Boston and how you responded to that tragedy. And the book ends with an absolutely lovely account of your mother's courageous battle with cancer. And what an inspiration she was to all of you right to the end. Life is good, you say, is the Swiss Army knife of gratitude. I want to finish there. Explain that phrase. Life is good is the Swiss Army knife of gratitude.
Well, it's actually the phrase that we refer to there. It's get to. And it was one we picked up from our community. And it's the idea that you don't say, you don't choose to say, I have to go, you know, to a meeting. I have to go grocery shopping. I have to do the laundry. You get to go to a meeting because you have a job. You get to do the bills because you have a roof over your head. You get to go grocery shopping because you live in a world of, you know, a land of abundance, and you've got eyes to read the labels. I mean, it's a simple one-word switch, but we learned it from our community, and it's extremely powerful. We apply it to work and home, and we feel like it's the Swiss Army knife of gratitude.
And we get to be on the road right now for 60 days, and one thing we want to enable people to do is help us raise money for kids while we're on the road promoting this book. If people hashtag grow the good and tell us something good that happened today, then we're going to donate another dollar to kids who need it. We've raised over $11 million for kids who need it, and we're very ambitious about raising more. So your listeners, just hashtag life is good. Hashtag grow the good, and for every hashtag, we'll donate another dollar.
Wonderful.
Think of that. I mean, that benefits the person writing it, because they're focused on thinking about the highlight, just like our mom taught us at the dinner table. And it's benefiting whoever's reading it. You know, they're reading that instead of hearing about the latest disaster. We feel like that's really powerful around the world.
Of course. This new book is just terrific, start to finish. Again, it's called Life is Good, The Book, How to Live with Purpose and Enjoy the Ride, published by National Geographic and written by the co-creators of Life is Good, Bert and John Jacobs. Bert and John Jacobs, thank you so much for all that you do, and thank you for creating this terrific book. I am so glad we got to talk about it today. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it very much.
Coming up this weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, Lynn Perrell's book, Pink Think, Becoming a Woman in Many Uneasy Lessons, and Carson Lord's book, The Modern Prince, What Leaders Need to Know Now. He's an expert in Machiavelli. Next week, some very exciting morning shows. On Monday for Martin Luther King Day, I'll be rebroadcasting my memorable conversation with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race, probably the single most thought-provoking conversation I can remember having on The Morning Show about race and racism. On Tuesday, another rebroadcast, but for a very timely reason. Emily St. John Mandel's book, Station 11, was the topic of the Big Read Project in 2017-2018 here in southeastern Wisconsin. I want to rebroadcast my memorable conversation with her because this book has been adapted into a very highly regarded miniseries available on HBO Max. And in another way in which this interview is timely, the book is about the world trying to rebuild itself after a devastating flu pandemic. On Wednesday, Peter Bonney, the author of Uprooted, Family Trauma, Unknown Origins, and the Secretive History of Artificial Insemination, he talks about the experience of learning that he was the product of artificial insemination and traces the history of this sometimes complicated technology. Nan Calvert joins us on Thursday, and Andrew Bernard from Carthage on Friday.